Hello and welcome to The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and alexlinder.com as a permanent archive. Today we're going to do a comparatively brief chapter, 22, Lorraine Hansberry, of The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History by E. Michael Jones at culturewars.com. I looked at the end notes. There aren't too many that are really relevant. There's no meaty ones to read, so let's just begin. We're on page 849. This is a short chapter. It's only about a little under 15 pages, or up to 862, which is blank, so really only about 12 pages. On October 25th, 1940, the Supreme Court heard arguments in the case of Hansberry v. Lee, a case which challenged restrictive covenants, a real estate ploy which prevented blacks from moving into all-white neighborhoods. Carl Hansberry, a black Chicago businessman, was looking for a property to buy on the south side of Chicago. In 1937, he found James Joseph Burke, a disgruntled former member of the Woodlawn Property Owners Association, who had vowed revenge on the organization that had done him wrong. Burke made good on his threat to, quote, get even with the Woodlawn Property Owners Association by putting niggers in every block, and that's a direct quote, that whole thing, of the Washington Park subdivision, beginning with Carl Hansberry, who conspired with Burke to buy a three-flat brick building at 6140 South Rhodes Avenue, which he knew the law barred him from buying. Historians have concluded that, quote, indeed, a conspiracy existed, but they have also concluded that Hansberry was involved, quote, in a necessary conspiracy because, quote, the intrigue was aimed at righting a wrong. So it's okay if you do an illegal thing for the right reasons, is the principle there. Necessary or not, this conspiracy to deprive a Negro of his rights did not include the usual suspects. This time, there were no frog-eyed Southern bigots with tobacco juice dripping from their chins. This time, the enemies of racial equality were the Supreme Life Insurance Company, which pumped more than $100,000 into fighting this case, and Robert Maynard Hutchins, president of the Rockefeller-endowed University of Chicago, who told Hansberry's lawyers, it's a matter of economics. The university has a huge investment in the South Side, and I've got to protect it. Why don't you people stay where you belong? The language of the covenant was frankly racial, defining a Negro as, quote, every person having one-eighth part or more of Negro blood or having any appreciable mixture of Negro blood, and every person who is what is commonly known as a colored person. But the situation in Chicago was different than the situation in the South. Chicago was a city of ethnic neighborhoods. The race riot of 1919 convinced the city fathers that the best way to keep the peace in an ethnically diverse city was ethnic pluralism, with each neighborhood in its own quasi-independent fiefdom. In the wake of the first wave of black migration up from the South during World War I, Southern blacks were treated like one of the many immigrant ethnic groups which had already come to Chicago by being assigned to their own ethnic territory in the same way that the Germans, Poles, and Irish had in the past. The Catholic Church in Chicago, which would later be blamed for promoting segregation, simply adopted the ethnic neighborhood pattern when it set up its parishes. According to the official history of the Archdiocese of Chicago, a local parish was far more than a place of worship. It was also a community center where immigrants could congregate and intermarry with people of the same language and customs. Throughout the 19th century, therefore, each Catholic ethnic group built a separate community in Chicago. The instruction in parochial schools was in the language of the immigrant group which had settled in that particular neighborhood, something that highlighted the fact that, quote, not just education, but every aspect of Catholic life and worship was subdivided along ethnic lines, with the Irish, Germans, and Poles forming the major leagues of ethnic Chicago. Black Catholics were no exception to this rule and were considered an ethnic group like any other. If they could raise the money, they would have their own church and ethnic parish. Segregation is a word that emerged during the time of redemption in the South, but it got applied to the situation in the North nonetheless, often by people who knew that the two situations were different, as when Kantorowicz writes that black parishes were segregated because most ethnic groups at the time were segregated, at least in part, of their own volition. Segregation in the South, needless to say, was not voluntary. In Chicago, immigrant groups banded together in particular neighborhoods for mutual support. Ethnicity, and not laws created to bring about separation of races, determined the makeup of Chicago's neighborhoods and therefore its parishes. Quote, in 1916, the Catholic Church in the city of Chicago consisted of 93 territorial, mainly Irish, parishes, with 235,600 members, 35 German parishes with 62,700 parishioners, and 34 Polish parishes, counting 208,700 parish members. The minor leagues accounted for an additional 53 parishes and 139,200 parishioners. The 646,200 active members of the Catholic Church in Chicago formed about 30% of the city's population. Ethnic divisions were all pervasive whenever one looked throughout the archdiocese. Cardinal Mundelein, a third-generation German-American and a confirmed Americanizer, tried to revoke, quote, the ethnic peace treaty that was the model for the Chicago Archdiocese, but the neighborhood was such an integral part of the warp and woof of Chicago that no one man could change it. Mundelein declared a moratorium on the establishment of new ethnic parishes, insisted that the language of instruction in all subjects, except catechism and reading, in parochial schools had to be English, and steadfastly refused to name any Polish auxiliary bishops, but Chicago remained stubbornly ethnic in spite of his efforts. Mundelein's Americanizing may well have exacerbated the racial situation because in refusing to allow new ethnic groups to found their own parishes, he denied black Catholics from the South the same rights as every other ethnic group had enjoyed when the black migrants needed them most, namely during the great period of migration up from Mississippi, which stretched from 1919 to 1960. In Americanizing Chicago Catholics, the Catholic bishops adopted racial categories that were alien to their European immigrant flock. Mundelein, like his contemporary Cardinal Doherty in Philadelphia, refused to see black Catholics as just another ethnic group and insisted upon their integration into existing parishes. This was not only disruptive, it also brought about Americanization in a way that neither man intended by introducing recently arrived European Catholics to the racial system of the American South and convincing them that they were white, quote unquote. This in turn thwarted the very integration that Mundelein's integrative Americanizing wanted to foster. It was a problem that would grow with time as both black migration and covert government-sponsored social engineering grew during the war years. Knowing that he was in for a hard legal fight, Hansberry and his attorney, C. Francis Stratford, approached Earl Dickinson, or Earl Dickerson, the star legal counsel for the NAACP. By the time Hansberry and his lawyer had contacted them, the NAACP, as well as the AJC, had decided to move beyond fighting discrimination on a case-by-case basis. The change in strategy was largely the result of a report written in 1931, the same year that the Scottsboro Boys went on trial for the first time, by Nathan Margold, a Romanian Jewish immigrant who had studied law at Harvard. Margold's report proposed an, quote, unprecedented all-out attack on segregation itself, including attacks on restrictive covenants and housing discrimination in the North, where segregation was not de jure. It wasn't by law, it was by custom. By the time Hansberry and his lawyers contacted Earl Dickerson, Nathan Margold's report had become the Bible of the NAACP. During the 1930s and 40s, Jews at organizations like the American Jewish Committee began to apply the principles of Boasian environmental sociology and anthropology to the burning questions of the day, the most burning of which were the rise of Nazism in Germany and the continuing hegemony of white racism in the American South. American Jews continued to be haunted by the specter of Leo Frank, and the emerging world situation during the 1930s did little to calm their fears. The other side was just as anxious. As the circumstances surrounding the Scottsboro Boys trials became better known, the South began to fear that once again they were the victims of outside agitation. Quote, the niggers and Jews of New York are working hand in hand, Senator Theodore Bilbo was quoted as saying in the Jewish Exponent. Whether he actually said that or not, the Jews of New York were hard at work turning Boasian social science into weapons they could use against their enemies. Their weapons were largely legal and would be put in the service of what later came to be known as social engineering. War, as John B. Watson had said when his book Behaviorism appeared in 1915, was itself a form of social engineering that would provide the perfect cover for what they had in mind. The Second World War also corresponded to a changing of the guard in which the previous generation of Germans, German Jewish patricians, Jacob Schiff, Louis Marshall, Julius Rosenwald, and Joel Spingarn, these are the ones who founded the NAACP and funded the Soviet Union, were replaced by a younger generation drawn almost exclusively from the ranks of the Ostjuden, the East Jews, that is the Russian Jews, who had arrived during the period of upheaval in Russia following the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881, coincidentally right when the big wave of Jew immigration to the U.S. happened, and before immigration quotas were imposed in 1924, much against the squawking of the Jews. In 1943, John Slawson, who had been born in the Ukraine, became head of the American Jewish Committee and one of the leaders in what Murray Friedman calls the Jewish phase of the Civil Rights Revolution. The Jewish phase was heavily involved in the promotion of Jewish social science as the main weapon in the fight against fascism. Under Slawson's leadership, the AJC was, quote, the primary organizer of the social science-based attack on religious and racial discrimination. In his capacity as the head of the AJC, Slawson began promoting the work of the Frankfurt School refugees who had found their way to America during the 1930s. These are the people Hitler kicked out. In addition to the work of Erich Fromm, Theodore Adorno, and Max Horkheimer, the AJC also sponsored the work of noted psychological warfare expert Kurt Lewin, K-U-R-T-L-E-W-I-N, who under the auspices of the AJC organized the Commission on Community Interrelations, whose principles would get put into practice in places like Chicago after the war by people like Lewis Wirth and Philip Klutznik, who went from being manager of Park Forest, one of the first experiments in using the car suburb as a form of social engineering, to being head of B'nai B'rith. Lewin was also instrumental in creating the form of social cohesion known as the T Group, or Sensitivity Group, which he hammered out with the help of a grant from the Office of Naval Research at his National Training Laboratory in Bethel, Maine. In promoting the work of the Frankfurt School refugees in America, Slawson, again this Ukrainian with an Anglo-type name, saw himself as following in the footsteps of Cyrus Adler, the AJC's third president, who, quote, thought it was essential to mobilize public opinion in the U.S. against Hitler and his party without any reference to Jews at all. His views were shared by the group's other German Jewish leaders who had helped to subsidize the work of Boas and related social scientists in the interest of demolishing the Nazis' master race mythology. The main difference between Slawson's and Adler's approach lay chiefly in the group which got targeted. After the war, the attack on fascism and racism that came to be known as social engineering was broadened to include not just Nazis, but a whole group of unwitting American citizens who would have been outraged if they had known that their own government was collaborating with groups like the AJC to change their behavior. In May 1944, Slawson convened a conference on anti-Semitism at the Biltmore Hotel in New York. At that conference, members of the AJC's psychological warfare team, including Adorno, Horkheimer, and Lewin, joined up with prominent members of the American social science establishment like Gordon Allport, John Dollard, Paul Lazarsfeld, Talcott Parsons, and Lloyd Warner to identify anti-Semitism as a central element in the anti-democratic personality. And that's a May 44 conference at Biltmore, New York. The culmination of Slawson's efforts came in 1949-1950 with the publication of the Studies in Prejudice series. These enormously influential books, Friedman tells us, were sponsored and paid for by the American Jewish Committee. The series' central volume, The Authoritarian Personality, extended and strengthened Fromm's ideas. What followed was a barrage of covert social engineering unleashed onto unsuspecting Americans who were now accused of turning their children into little fascists if they ignored the Frankfurt School version of how to raise them. When Bess Meyerson became the first Jewish Miss America, she joined the ADL's roster of speakers and went from school to school spreading the message, "You can't be beautiful and hate." The Studies in Prejudice series never really got around to naming the domestic enemy who is now the successor to Nazism, but before long it became clear that the AJC was promoting an attack on the two groups in particular. Southern whites and Catholic ethnics in the big cities of the North have become the prime candidates for the Authoritarian Personality Award. As some indication of the groups that the AJC and their social science arm did not like, Leo Pfeffer, a German word for pepper, P-F-E-F-F-E-R, lawyer for the AJC and other Jewish organizations in the school prayer decisions of the 60s, once said that whenever his daughter wanted to get back at him, she threatened to marry a Catholic army officer from Alabama. As if on cue, Joe McCarthy, the German-Irish Catholic senator from Wisconsin, emerged as the, quote, dangerous demagogue, who perfectly epitomized the authoritarian personality described in the classic study, proving, if nothing else, that the psychological warfare techniques which got developed during the war were now going to be used against opponents of the Black-Jewish Alliance under the guise of social therapy. Soon Frankfurt School messages began cropping up all over the place. The readers of Collier's magazine, which later published The Body Snatchers, which got made into the film The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, an early protest against social engineering, got to read The Outcast by B.J. Schutte, which presented in fictional form an indictment of anti-Semitic covenants in real estate. Not even Broadway musicals were exempt from doing duty as covert social engineering. Theaters who went to see South Pacific were treated to, quote, carefully taught, which Freeman describes as a show-stopping song, stating that children had to be taught to hate, which made the point in a way that Theodore Adorno and his colleagues at the AJC could never have dreamed possible. It was during the post-war period when Boasian anthropology began to be applied via the Frankfurt School as part of the mechanism which used social engineering to combat prejudice that the modern civil rights movement began to take shape. It's a little confusing there because if he uses the invasion of the body snatchers as an example, it's not like they were saying the pod people were the good people. It's like they were fighting them. Everyone has a perverse engineer. The pods were taking over. So that would be kind of an, if it's talking about social engineering, it certainly wouldn't be positive again for it. It'd be against it. So that's a little confusing to me there. Lorraine Hansberry was 10 years old when her father won his Supreme Court case. Carl Hansberry, who would later claim that he had made a killing on the Rhodes Avenue building, would go on to make an even greater killing, exploiting his newfound leverage in the Chicago real estate market. Now each time his or any other black family moved into a previously white neighborhood, panic ensued, and as white families dumped their houses on the market, black entrepreneurs like Hansberry could buy them up for a song and then sell them at premium prices. A housing market could then command to the new migrants from the South. Black real estate, so they're block busting and they're profiteering off this new social engineering reflected in changed real estate law that outlaws freedom of association, a constitutional right. So you don't longer have the ability to work with others to protect your neighborhood from these marauding blacks and their stupid violence. Black real estate speculators made a killing, wrote Truman K. Gibson, whose other client, Claude Barnett, director of the Associated Negro Press, quote, bought three buildings and confided to me that they were the best investments he ever made because they came at so little cost. Hansberry was a Republican who ran unsuccessfully for Congress in the November 1940 election. He was also the black version of the American Calvinist Jew Marx described in Zur Judenfrage. Hansberry was a member of what W.E.B. Du Bois would have called the Talented Tenth and the nation's, quote, colored aristocracy, including Du Bois, felt welcome in his home, but Hansberry was also a slum landlord who had no qualms about exploiting his own people. Biographies of his more famous daughter sometimes list him as the inventor of the kitchenette apartment, which is another way of describing how he destroyed the large homes on the South Side by putting in sinks and toilets in what used to be bedrooms and living rooms and then renting them at exorbitant prices to the newly arrived sharecroppers from Mississippi. Carl Sons, under the name of Hansberry Enterprises, would carry on the same tradition in the 1950s after Carl Sr.'s death, demanding large deposits from Mississippi sharecroppers and then evicting them so that Hansberry Enterprises could cash in on the next wave of unfortunate Negroes. Lorraine Hansberry's biographer suggests that Carl Sr.'s death at age 51 was arguably caused by the strains of racism. She also speculates that racism led to Lorraine's death of duodenal cancer at the age of 34. But in the case of Carl Sr., bad business deals and extramarital affairs probably caused as much stress in his life as racism did. In the case of his daughter, class conflict was a bigger issue than racial conflict, because the Hansberrys were well off by anyone's definition of the term in the 1930s and 40s. If anything, the Hansberry family profited handsomely from their exploitation of the racial situation in America. Carl Sr. made a killing in real estate after the Supreme Court allowed him to cause panic in white neighborhoods with impunity. Lorraine's sister Mamie claims that her father, quote, made quite a fortune during the Depression because the white landlord simply couldn't collect the rent and he could. And Lorraine Hansberry went on to become America's foremost black playwright in her day. The Hansberrys were so well off, in fact, that they could afford to buy Lorraine an ermine coat for her fifth birthday. Lorraine wore her fur coat not to church on Sunday, but to school during the week, with unfortunate consequences. Hansberry's fellow students, who considered themselves lucky if they had shoes on their feet and a bologna sandwich for lunch during the depths of the Depression, were so outraged by the Hansberry's ostentatious display of wealth that they threw ink on Lorraine's fur coat and beat her up. If, as her biographer contends, Lorraine Hansberry was an outsider, it was her wealth and not her race which made her one. If anything contributed to Lorraine's sense of herself as an outsider, it was the stigma of coming from a family of slum landlords. Consciousness of this fact made both generations of Hansberrys uncomfortable in Chicago and eager to leave. When he died suddenly at the age of 51, Carl Sr. was planning to move to Mexico. Lorraine left Chicago at the age of 18 and never returned. In A Raisin in the Sun, the play which made her famous, Hansberry could allow Benethea, or Benita, you never quite know if it's a typo in this book, between Jones's typos and Black's propensity for insane names, who knows what the name actually is. Hansberry could allow Benita, literally beneath A is how it's spelled, to distance herself from Chicago by fantasizing about an imaginary African past in which she conflated all of the continent's black ethnic groups into one proto-revolutionary mass. But her knowledge of Africa was limited at best, and not firsthand. Pan-Africanism may have been a fact of life in Chicago, but it was never really caught on in Africa, as the numerous ethnic wars and genocides there indicate. At one point, Hansberry claimed that Muzungu was the Kikuyu word name for Europeans, and that it derived from he who is dizzy. Mzungu, M-Z-U-N-G-U, the word for white person, however, is Swahili, not Kikuyu, and it is etymologically related to the verb to wander. In 1950, Hansberry dropped out of the University of Wisconsin at Madison and moved to New York, where she took writing classes at the New School for Social Research, and that's the Frankfurt School, that's where it reestablished in America, and worked as an assistant editor at Paul Robeson's new magazine. He was a black communist and actor. Freedom, he's written about in Libido Dominandi. So this black slumlord Hansberry's daughter, who becomes the most famous black playwright, is studying under Paul Robeson at the New School for Social Research in New York. The dichotomy is evident in her major, skipped ahead a bit there. It was at this point she became the intellectual revolutionary that she would be for the rest of her short life. Cheney sees a duality in Hansberry's life, claiming that she, quote, never fully resolved the duality of her life and works, upper middle class affluence, and black heritage and revolution. But she leaves out the main source of the dichotomy. Like Claude McKay, W.A. Domingo, Richard Wright, and many other black writers, Lorraine Hansberry learned about revolution from the Jews she met in New York. The dichotomy is evident in her major works. Hansberry's first play, A Raisin in the Sun, is suffused with a Chicago that is both black and Christian, and as a result, suffused with moral indignation against abortion and atheism. The window in Sidney Brustein's window, Her second play is suffused with bohemian Jewish New York, but also with Hansberry's attempt to come to grips with this alien culture. And the first is widely assigned, I believe, A Raisin in the Sun. The second I've never even heard of. I have not read either myself, actually. On June 20th, 1953, Hansberry married Robert Nemiroff, a Jewish literature student and songwriter whom she had met on a picket line protesting discrimination at New York University, or NYU. Together they worked odd jobs in the publishing industry and lived La Vie Boheme, the bohemian life, in Greenwich Village. Then, in 1956, Nemiroff wrote a hit song, Cindy, Oh Cindy, which earned him $100,000. Financially secure with the money from her husband's song, Hansberry quit her day job, devoted herself to writing full-time, and completed a play about her experience growing up in Chicago, which she tentatively titled The Crystal Stair, after a line in the Langston Hughes poem. It wasn't an auspicious moment for the Black Jewish Alliance. Friedman claims that there was nothing phony or contrived about the commitment of most Jewish communists to black civil rights. To counter that claim, Cruz mentions that around the time that Hansberry arrived in New York, the Jewish communist in charge of the Harlem branch of the party had ordered Harlem's Negro Party members to protest Ninotchka at the Apollo Theater, even though it was obvious that the Negroes had nothing to gain from the protest. Who but a Russian Jew would have been offended by Ernst Lubitsch casting Greta Garbo as a commissar who falls in love with her counterpart from the West in Paris? Cruz makes it clear that the Negroes had no dog in that fight. Harold Cruz provides an interesting counterpoint to the career of Lorraine Hansberry. Like Hansberry, Cruz was a black migrant to New York. Cruz was born in Petersburg, Virginia on March 8, 1916, and moved to Harlem as a teenager. Like Hansberry, Cruz was an intellectual revolutionary who spent a number of years in the Communist Party learning revolution at the feet of Russian Jews. In this particular instance, Cruz was a member of the Communist Party from 1945 until 1952. When he left the party at the age of 36, Cruz had gained a, quote, position of considerable respect among Harlem communists. He's someone Jones quotes a lot. He's obviously a very smart guy. Like Hansberry, Cruz was interested in the theater and spent the 1950s, like Hansberry, trying to get a musical produced on Broadway. Like Hansberry, Cruz lived among the bohemians of Greenwich Village. At this point, the profiles begin to diverge. Leroy Jones remembers Cruz as a writer, not a political activist, who would frequent the Café Figaro at the Village and who was always complaining about how Broadway producers were turning down the musicals he was writing. Unlike Hansberry, Cruz never made contact with anyone who wanted to back his plays, confirming his belief that Jews controlled Broadway for their own interests. By the early 1950s, it had become clear to people like Cruz that the only reason the Jews who controlled the party were interested in Harlem was to turn Negroes into revolutionaries and use them to fight their battles. Cruz mentions the headline in the Amsterdam News of September 29, 1951. Quote, Communist Woo Harlem. Open big drive-in local area. As a clear indication, quote, that the communist had retreated to Harlem because, quote, this belabored, belittled community is considered to be America's weakest link of resistance against the movement. Friedman, who wrote his book in the Black Jewish Alliance to refute Cruz, admits the same thing when he writes, quote, during the period of the Cold War, the tendency was to describe American communists as tools of Moscow, utilizing the grievances of blacks for party interest alone. Friedman gives even more evidence to support the thesis that the Jews were using Negroes as revolutionary cannon fodder from the life of Richard Wright, even though he seems unaware that he is undermining his own thesis that there was nothing phony or contrived about the commitment of most Jewish communists to black civil rights in the act of presenting it. Quote, as we move on to 857, about four pages left. In The God That Failed, Wright describes the presence of so many Jewish artists and writers in the movement as exhilarating. A Jew writer invited him to a meeting of the John Reed Club on Chicago's South Side, where he was introduced to a group of young men and women who were to become leading painters, composers, novelists, and filmmakers. These men and women, all Jewish, formed with him the first sustained relationships of his life, and although he looked hard, he found no condescension in them. Wright, who twice married Jewish women, has a Jewish communist, Boris Max, defend his black protagonist in Native Son. When the protagonist refuses to cooperate in a police investigation because police hate black folks, Wright has Max reply, "They hate others, too. They hate me because I'm trying to help you. They're writing me letters, calling me a dirty Jew." Shortly after Hansberry and Nemirov moved into their apartment on Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village, the Supreme Court handed down Brown v. Board of Education, and what has come to be known as the Civil Rights Movement came into existence. Brown struck down Plessy v. Ferguson's concept of separate but equal, which was the cornerstone of the South's redemption and the North's withdrawal from Reconstruction. Brown, in turn, found its theoretical basis in Gunnar Myrdal's book, An American Dilemma, which was a creation of the psychological warfare establishment under the direction of Samuel Stouffer and Lewis Wirth, the University of Chicago sociologist who worked for the Office of War Information during the war. So, Brown knocks down separate but equal, the base of the North's withdrawing from Reconstruction, allowing redemption to happen, and the Southerners set up their separate apartheid sort of society. And then that's overturned in 1954, separate but equal in the case Plessy v. Ferguson is replaced by Brown. Brown bases its decision not on the law, but on social science concocted as a means of psychological warfare by these Jews in the Office of War Information, these Jew sociologists and other social scientists at the University of Chicago, Lewis Wirth and Sam Stouffer. And Lewis Wirth actually wrote most of Gunnar Myrdal, the Swedes, a non-Jew, a Swedes, book, The American Dilemma, about race. So it's presented as this outside foreign neutral guy analyzing it, but it turns out it's actually a homegrown Jew revolutionary. As Murray Friedman hints, Myrdal did not and could not have written An American Dilemma, nor did he need to, since it was going to be based on the Boasian school of environmental sociology and anthropology anyway, and there were plenty of Boasians in the United States. The Boasians needed Myrdal as their front man, a Swede, because otherwise the Brown decision ran the danger of being derided as based on Jewish science. The Jews, particularly those at the NAACP, were, of course, intimately involved with the Brown decision. Felix Frankfurter, Chief Justice on the Supreme Court, handed down the Brown, was a German-speaking Jew from Vienna who served on the NAACP's legal committee. Jack Greenberg of the NAACP, Friedman tells us, quote, drew the assignment to find experts in the Midwest for the landmark case, Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. Kenneth B. Clark, the black psychologist whose study of black and white dolls indicated that students were harmed by segregated classrooms, was cited in Brown, had been funded by the AJC. Clark's study led the court to conclude that, quote, the average black American had been scarred by self-hatred, and that segregation inflicted vast psychic damage on both white and black children. So they're scarred when they're segregated, and when they're exposed to whites, they're around racism, so it's all a bunch of garbage, it's all lies, it's all intended to destroy whites, and it all uses non-Jews and science as its cover story, its pretext for these changes. AJC-sponsored psychological studies festooned the decision from one footnote to another. Friedman concludes after the fact that Clark's research was flawed, but 50 years after the fact, the point was moot. Flawed or not, the Jewish-sponsored research that made up the theoretical underpinning for the Brown decision had gotten the job done. Brown created both an atmosphere conducive to revolution and a weapon that could be used against the South for what it had done to Leo Frank. The court's May 17, 1954 decision, as Friedman put it, would spur the civil rights revolution that followed. Friedman claims that the Black-Jewish alliance did not exist in Dixie for good reasons. First of all, the South lacked Jewish revolutionaries. There were no Joel Spingarns there, is how Friedman put it. Secondly, Southern Jews had been intimidated by the lynching of Leo Frank, who remained a ghostly idol into the 50s. Northern Jews, who, like their Southern counterparts, grew up with the thought of Frank's lynching never far from their minds, had no qualms about antagonizing Southerners because they didn't have to live with them, and soon began to harass the South in an increasingly overt manner, one which culminated in the Freedom Summer of 1964, immortalized by the line from the Alan Sherman song, "How's your sister Ida? She's a freedom rider." Incredibly unfunny, Alan Sherman. When 19 rabbis... When 19 rabbis from the North arrived in Birmingham in 1963 to take part in protests against segregation and teach the local Negroes how to sing Hava Nagila, a delegation of Southern Jews met the, quote, 19 messiahs, unquote, as they were called by local Jews, and asked them to go home. Ironically or not, Friedman concludes that it was not the racists, but rather the Jewish civil rights protesters from the North and West, whom Southern Jews feared the most. This sort of revolutionary meddling soon created the reaction in the South which Southern Jews feared. Before long, Jew and communist had become synonyms in the South. Unlike the good Southern Jews, the New York Jews had come South with one purpose in mind, to stir up the Negroes and turn them into communist revolutionaries. Representative Johnny Rankin, who introduced legislation in Congress to outlaw the ADL, claimed that the better element of Jews throughout the South and West was not only ashamed, but also alarmed by the activities of the Jewish communists, who were responsible for the rapes and murders of white girls by vicious Negroes. In addition, Friedman notes that in 1948, a prominent member of the Daughters of the Confederacy's North Carolina chapter circulated a letter charging that most of the communists in the United States were Jews, and that most agitators stirring up Southern Negroes were of Jewish origin. Jews also supplied most of the money for such activities. The suspicions of the Southerners were justified, but they were demonized for having them nonetheless. In Travels with Charlie, a book which John Steinbeck dedicated to New York publisher and NAACP supporter Harold Ginsburg, Steinbeck runs into a cab driver in Louisiana who tells him that them goddamn New York Jews come in and stir the niggers up. When Steinbeck picks up a cracker hitchhiker who tells him he sounds like a commie nigger lover, Steinbeck loses no time in expelling the man from the RV, which has come to symbolize deracinated America, for saying the same things that Murray Friedman would note with pride some 30 years later. By the time Friedman got around to writing his book in 1995, the civil rights movement was not only good or necessary conspiracy, it was the Black Jewish Alliance's finest hour. Up until the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955, the Jews dominated the civil rights movement. Indeed, the NAACP, which was founded in 1909, did not have one black lawyer on its staff until 1933. After Montgomery, however, the black masses now became the shock troops and the central force in the civil rights revolution. As if to prove that Steinbeck's cab driver was right all along, Friedman cites the case of Bayard Rustin, a Negro Quaker homosexual who attended City College of New York with its Stalinist and Trotskyite alcoves in the lunchroom, and joined the Young Communist League after he arrived in New York. In the summer of 1956, Bayard Rustin introduced Martin Luther King Jr. to Stanley Levison, a political radical who had worked on behalf of the convicted Atom spies Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who was also, quote, a financial pillar of the Communist Party and other radical causes. Levison would go on to become an enormously influential behind the scenes and throughout King's career. Friedman King claims that Levison became, quote, King's closest white friend and most reliable colleague for the remainder of his life, and would epitomize the Black Jewish Alliance's new look. Levison got his start in, there's no N there, it's Levison. Levison got his start in politics shortly after the war when he became a financial contributor to the Communist Party. By 1953, he was assisting in the management of party finances, a job which included creating business fronts which would earn or launder money for the party. J. Edgar Hoover believed that Levison was under party discipline when he entered the King movement. When Martin Luther King announced the creation of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1957, it was Levison, and Rustin, who labored behind the scenes in New York to provide the $200,000 a year the SCLC needed for its operations in the South. Eventually, Rustin and Levison were joined by two more members of the Black Jewish Alliance, Jack O'Dell, a black communist, and Harry Wachtel. Together, they came up with a list of 9,000 donors who were willing to make semi-annual contributions to the SCLC to fund its operations. In 1963, the Kennedy brothers, Jack and Bobby, persuaded King to cut his ties with Bayard Rustin, but King never broke with Levison, and in fact spoke with him on the phone until King's death in 1968. Friedman gives conflicting accounts of the amount of Jewish money that ended up in the coffers of the SCLC. After citing Levison's claim that only some 10% of SCLC's money came from Jews, Friedman goes on to say that Jewish support was so important, quote, that King's advisors considered dropping the word Christian from the organization's title, and that Bayard Rustin, quote, never failed to remind King to mention the Judeo-Christian tradition in his speeches. On March 11, 1959, the play Lorraine Hansberry had been working on since 1956 opened in New York at the Ethel Barrymore Theater as A Raisin in the Sun and became an instant success. In addition to winning that year's New York Critics Circle Award as Best Drama of the Year, Hansberry received congratulations by telegram from Tennessee Williams, was named Most Promising Playwright of the Year by Variety in June 1959, and sold the movie rights to the play to Columbia Pictures. Hansberry's newfound fame allowed her to become a spokesman for the civil rights movement, which had reached a new phase of revolutionary development. Now, instead of simply waiting for incidents to develop which could lead to litigation, the civil rights movement had taken to provoking incidents, which would invariably get televised and generate more revolutionary fervor by creating a violent backlash. In February 1960, four black students created the sit-in movement when they sat down at a whites-only lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, and demanded service. The students were then beaten when they refused to leave, and the sit-in movement was born as a form of passive-aggressive behavior, and the movement took another step toward violent revolution. The sit-in movement soon found wide support among the nation's Jews, a fact that James Farmer of the Congress for Racial Equality exploited in his fundraising speeches. On the advice of his fundraiser, Marvin Rich, Farmer never gave a speech without reciting what Rich called the quote, Hillel's admonition, quote, "If I am not for myself, who will be for me? But if I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? When?" Farmer relied on another Jew, Morris Milgram, for organizational assistance, and together Milgram and Farmer recruited Jews from the Workers' Defense League and the Young People's Socialist Alliance to fill the top administrative posts at CORE. Once the success of the sit-in movement became apparent, Stokely Carmichael, another black Jamaican from New York City, broke with the SCLC and created the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1960 to escalate the movement. Marion Barry, who became famous later as the first mayor of Washington, D.C. to be arrested on a charge of cocaine possession, was elected first chairman of SNCCI, and he was the mayor when I was there, and he was caught on tape smoking crack. That was special. In the spring of 1961, Farmer and CORE called for a series of interracial, quote, freedom rides on public buses throughout the South, and the Jewish freedom riders headed south to spread revolution. Friedman estimates that Jews probably made up two-thirds of the white freedom riders in the South in the summer of 61, and about one-third to half of the Mississippi summer volunteers 3 years later. Even Arthur Spingarn, then in his 80s, got into the act. Unlike the SCLC, SNCC did not bar communists from membership, a fact which enabled still more New York Jews to pour into the movement. The massive numbers of arrests that the sit-in movement and the Freedom Riders generated required an army of lawyers, and more than half of them, including Ed Koch, future mayor of New York City, were Jews. More than half of them were Jews, the lawyers defending these people, many of whom are Jews themselves. Of the three civil rights workers murdered in Mississippi, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, two were Jews and one was black. Schwerner, who was the primary target of the killers because of his longer involvement with the civil rights workers in Mississippi, was an atheist who saw the civil rights movement as the cutting edge of messianic politics, which had always sought to create heaven on earth by wielding the sword, even if the revolutionary sword was disguised by the tactics of nonviolence. It's a good disguise. Quote, "It was because Schwerner had no hope of heaven that he held such extravagant hopes here on earth, and for many the pursuit of racial justice became a kind of secular religion. Rabbi Philip Bernstein made the point that the Jewish radical who ignored his Jewishness was still the product of his messianic fervor. Though he might not be aware of it, he was spiritually wearing his yarmulke as he headed south." Eventually, Friedman concludes, virtually every segment of the Jewish community enlisted in the civil rights struggle. Nothing would be the same again in the South, but a true revolution was underway. My emphasis, says Jones, on true revolution. As in Harlem in the 20s, many of the black leaders of the movement had learned their tactics from revolutionary Jews. Robert Moses, the charismatic black leader of the SNCC's Mississippi Summer Project, quote, was a product of the black Jewish radical culture, having attended a Jewish socialist camp as a child and become friends with Jewish young people from similar radical backgrounds. The Black Jewish Alliance reached its moment of triumph during the famous 1963 March on Washington, when Bob Dylan, the world's most famous Jewish folk singer, sang, and Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. 3 months earlier, however, when King met with John and Robert Kennedy in the White House on June 22nd, he was told in no uncertain terms that his organization had ties to and was possibly controlled by the Communist Party. Robert Kennedy claimed that the SCLC's fundraiser, Stanley Levison, quote, was acting on Soviet orders to weaken the U.S. by manipulating the civil rights movement. John Kennedy, who was under pressure from Southern Democrats to rein in the civil rights movement, named Odell as, quote, the number five communist in the United States, and claimed that Levison was his handler. Acting under pressure from the Kennedys, King fired Odell on July 3rd, but maintained covert contact with the less dispensable Levison, whom Friedman refers to as King's, quote, closest white advisor. Deprived of the Jews and communists that provided the backbone of its financial and administrative support, the SCLC, which was now staffed by Southern Negroes who sat around the office talking to each other, started to fall apart. So no one is capable of organizing and funding the way the Jews are, at least certainly not among the blacks. And that ends that chapter. Not too much more to say about that other than Jews are completely behind the flip in the law that took away the white constitutional right to free association. And a lot more could have been said about that from a racial point of view. Of course, Jones is not big on race. You can't tell exactly what he thinks, but he seems to believe that if they just allowed ethnic parishes to build up the way they had, there wouldn't have been any problem. But in any case, we see that Jews are using the blacks to wreck solid, stable, settled society, as they always do. They are erect termites. They must be exterminated and counter-exterminated, since they say and believe and practice even the best of the goyim should be killed. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.